Welcome to the Sermon Podcast of Redemption Church. The following sermon is by our pastoral resident, Scotty Miser.
So, if you've been with us for some past weeks, you'll know we've spent a lot of time in Isaiah, specifically in the exile passages. All the previous passages we've covered in Isaiah, Israel is in exile in the foreign city of Babylon, right? And every passage we've heard thus far has been words of comfort and promise of deliverance to a people in exile. Soon, the Israelites will be able to return to Jerusalem. That's what we keep hearing over and over again. Soon, you're gonna get to go back to Jerusalem. Now here in chapter 55, for you Bible nerds keeping score at home, we have now moved into a new section of Isaiah. Isaiah is often divided by scholars into thirds. We've been in what is known as Deutero-Isaiah, and we are now moving on into Trito-Isaiah. So write that down, it's incredibly important. We're in Trito-Isaiah now. And the thing about Trito-Isaiah, the thing about chapter 55 onward, is it's no longer speaking to people who are in exile, promising deliverance. It's actually speaking to people who have returned to the city. It's speaking post-exile, people who have come back from Babylon and returned to Jerusalem. Now, if you've read any books like Ezra, and if you've read Nehemiah, you'll know that this return to Jerusalem, while beautiful and promised, was far from the end of the story, far from the end of the work that Israel had to get done. Turns out, and I have a picture here. Yeah, so it turns out after 70 years of neglect, Jerusalem was a little shabby. The promise ended up being kind of disappointing on the surface level, and it would be years before it could be rebuilt to anything resembling its former glory. So we have these people who have been freed, and they come home. But home is disappointing. Even the return to home, there's brokenness, even outside of Babylon. There's still the stench of exile. And it's in that context that we receive this passage. I'm going to read it again, and I want you to consider it through the eyes of people who have returned home. They've been delivered, but they've been delivered to a home that disappoints. Come, all you who are thirsty. Come to the waters. And you who have no money, come buy and eat. Come buy wine and milk without money and without cost. Why spend money on what is not bread, and your labor on what does not satisfy? Listen, listen to me, and eat what is good, and you will delight in the richest of fare. Give ear and come to me. Listen that you may live. I will make an everlasting covenant with you, my faithful love, promised to David. See, I have made him a witness to the peoples, a ruler and commander of the peoples. Surely you will summon nations you know not, and nations you do not know will come running to you because of the Lord your God, the Holy One of Israel, for he has endowed you with splendor. Seek the Lord while he may be found. Call on him while he is near. Let the wicked forsake their ways, and the unrighteous their thoughts. Let them turn to the Lord, and he will have mercy on them, and to our God, for he will freely pardon. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. As the rain and the snow come down from heaven and do not return to it without watering the earth and making it bud and flourish so that it yields seed for the sower and bread for the eater, so is my word that goes out from my mouth. It will not return to me empty, but will accomplish what I desire and achieve the purpose for which I sent it. You will go out in joy and be led forth in peace. The mountains and hills will burst into song before you, and all the trees of the field will clap their hands. Instead of the thorn bush will grow the juniper, and instead of briars, the myrtle will grow. This will be for the Lord's renown, for an everlasting sign that will endure forever. It's one of those passages where I kind of feel like I'm doing it a disservice to give a sermon after it that kind of preaches itself. If you just imagine these words of plenty to a people returning to a broken city, these words that say, God has a feast for you. God isn't just going to make sure you survive. God's not just going to get you out of Babylon. God's got a feast waiting for you. And that's what I want y'all to take away from today. And Kat, you can turn to the sermon slides there. God's grace is a feast. It's not a ration that's going to run out. It's not something you have to wash up for. And it's not a VIP-only invite that's hard to get to. It's close by. It's free. It's a feast. God's grace is a feast. Amen? Is that a sort of a new-ish way of thinking about God's grace for you guys? Because I think I've heard a lot more of God's grace as the life raft. God's grace as the thing that just keeps you from dying and suffering. I think it's a little rarer for me to consider God's grace as a celebration, as a dinner invite. But God's grace is a feast. There's a couple things that I think that changes for us. So the first thing I want you to take away is that God's feast is abundant. God's feast is abundant. I want to look at those first two verses again of that chapter. Come, all you who are thirsty, come to the waters, and you who have no money, come buy and eat. Come buy wine and milk without money and without cost. Now, I have these colored differently because there's a clear change in tone here, right? Verse 1, you're thirsty, come to the waters, you have no money, come buy and eat. That's survival, okay? I'm going to give you bread, and I'm going to give you water. You're not going to starve. Then, as soon as verse 2, God takes it a step further, and he says, buy wine and milk without money and without cost. These aren't the foods of mere survival. These are the foods that God uses to illustrate celebration. When he calls the promised land the land of milk and honey, that's what he's talking about. He's talking about plenty. So I want to ask you guys, do we believe this? Do I believe this? Do you believe that God doesn't just want to save you from death, but he actually wants to give you life? Do you believe that God doesn't just want to bring you to zero, right? He doesn't just want to erase your debt. He doesn't just want to give you a clean slate. He wants to draw something on the slate after he's made it clean. Do you believe that God doesn't just care for you like a good but sort of grudging parent and wants to make sure you have enough war rations to survive, but that he actually likes you and wants to have you over for dinner? It's an absurd thing, I think, especially in the ancient world where deity was not something thought of intimately. So to sort of illustrate this overwhelming plenty, it actually makes me think of a story G.K. Chesterton tells. I have a picture of some Some cliffs. Yeah, there we go. So Chesterton tells this funny little story about a time when he went out to a southern England peninsula because he wanted to sketch. And he brought everything he needed. He wanted to make chalk sketches. And he just described the pure joy that making chalk sketches on brown butcher paper does. And if you're at all familiar with how Chesterton writes, he just waxes on for way too long about it. But he gets there, and he realizes he's forgot his chalk. He's forgotten his white chalk. And he starts beating himself up about it. He's miles out of town. He's nowhere near anywhere where he could go back and buy some white chalk. He's just there with his paper. And then he realizes he's actually sitting on a cliff that's made out of chalk. He's actually sitting on these white cliffs, and there's actually miles and miles and miles of white chalk just sitting beneath him. So he just breaks off a piece of the rock and he starts drawing. I just think of that just ridiculously overwhelming plenty. Like, do you think you're going to run out of chalk? Like, do you think you got enough? Is this enough for your sketches? Is this enough? These miles of white chalk beneath you. But do we think of God's grace this way? Do we think of God's grace not just as sufficient, but as overwhelming for our needs? I want you to just take a minute and think of the most gracious, most loving person you know. Think of someone who's not just nice to you, but someone who's been there, who's seen you mess up, and is still for you. Think of the most gracious, most loving person you know. Are we all got somebody? Now, do you think of God as more or less loving than that person? Friends, God is more loving than the most loving person you know. There is enough chalk. God's grace is a feast, and the feast is abundant. Amen? Second point I want to make about this feast is that it's free. And I think that's important because I think this verse tells us something we already know. In the verses that follow, verses 1 and 2, which would be verses 3 and 4, if we're keeping along, he asks, why spend money on what is not bread and your labor on what does not satisfy? So these verses, I think, they tell us something that we kind of already know. If we've been around for a little bit, we pretty much know that most things promising to give us life are a scam. Most things promising to give us life are actually set up to take it from us. David Foster Wallace talks about this in his speech, This is Water. And he has this to say. He says, in the day-to-day trenches of adult life, there is actually no such thing as atheism. There's no such thing as not worshiping. Everybody worships. The only choice we get is what to worship. And the compelling reason, he says, for maybe choosing some sort of God or spiritual type thing to worship, be it JC or Allah, or be it Yahweh or the Wiccan Mother Goddess or the Four Noble Truths or some inviolable set of ethical principles, is that pretty much anything else you worship will eat you alive. If you worship money and things, if they are where you tap real meaning in life, then you will never have enough, never feel you have enough. It's the truth. Worship your body and beauty and sexual allure, and you will always feel ugly. And when time and age start showing, you will die a million deaths before they finally grieve you. Do we believe that God's grace isn't like one of these things? Or do we secretly suspect God kind of needs something from us? Do we secretly suspect that God's wanting for something? That God doesn't have enough chalk? That there's not enough food at the feast? Do we believe that God's grace is like one of these things promising life but just leaving us tired? I think I often do think of God's grace, sadly, as something that God withholds until I get everything right, or at least until I get more right than I currently have right. I think of God as withholding it, but I don't think that the difficulties in experiencing God's grace are on God's end. I don't think when we face difficulties in journeying towards God, it's because of God and Him making it difficult. I think the difficulty comes in canceling our subscriptions to the other worships. I think what's difficult so often is letting go of our worship to money, to status, to moralism, to being seen as a good parent, to being seen as a good student. I think it's so hard to let that stuff go and receive the feast. The feast that truly nourishes. Does anyone else have trouble thinking of God in this way? Does anyone else kind of think like, I've got to, when I pray, when I enter into fellowship with God, I've got to kind of have a product. I've got to have, at the very least, like, I don't have to have everything together, but I at least have to have something to say about what I don't have together. I got to have something to present. I got to have something to bring to the potluck. One thing, I'm going to give you guys this practice, and I hope it helps. It's something I've used to help kind of counteract this notion in me, because I know that I so often worship at the altar of words and ideas and having the right ones in the right order. I find this prayer of, "Here I am, Lord," to be extremely helpful. Just to say, "Here I am, Jesus," and like, just to say that, just to show up. In like the stressful and the aggravating times, like, yeah, but also times that are just boring, I'll say, "Here I am, Jesus," sometimes when I'm just brushing my teeth. I'll say, "Here I am, Jesus," when I'm driving into the city, when I'm feeling tired on my way to work, even when I don't have anything to say about it. I'll just take these opportunities to say, "Here I am." Take that opportunity, friends, to just show up. Just to free yourself of the notion that you have to earn a ticket to the party with your heart or with your actions or with your words. Just show up. And let go, not because it's a requirement before God gives you His grace, but let go because when you let go of the other things you worship, you're going to be freer to receive the grace He's trying to give you already. Another thing that might help, if the "Here I am, Lord" thing doesn't sound like a helpful exercise for you, I read a while ago someone who said that talking to God is a lot like talking to your dog. Your dog listens to your words and he pays attention to them, but he largely ignores them in favor of how you smell. So I think sometimes we just kind of have to show up and let God smell us. Just show up with your stink. Show up. God's grace, it's a feast, all right? It's a feast. Amen. One more thing I want to give you is the idea that God's table is large. God's table is really, really big. And we see that in this chapter, actually, in some later verses, where God says to Israel, who, remember, has just come out of exile in a foreign land. They've just gotten out of Babylon. And now God says, hey, you're invited to a party, and guess who else is invited? Surely you will summon nations you know not, and nations you do not know will come running to you because of the Lord your God, the Holy One of Israel, for he has endowed you with splendor. Again, this is just an incredible thing to tell a destitute people who have been recently brought out of imprisonment in a foreign city. It's like, who's coming to the feast? Oh, other nations. Cool. Like, you've just gotten out of there. You've just gotten out of there, and now they're invited to the table too? But do you see how the rest of this feast imagery kind of leads up to that? When we realize that God's grace is a feast that won't run out of food, when we realize that God's table and a seat at it is something that we've received freely, I think it frees us up because we can become a lot less skeptical of where God's grace might then choose to go. And when we share the invitation, when as Israel, we speak to others on the outside and we invite them to a seat at God's table, it becomes a lot less about behavior modification. It becomes a lot less about cleaning people up so that they look their best when they meet God. It's more about getting people to realize that this party, this feast, this source of endless nourishment is actually the only place in the world that's asking nothing of you. It's the only place in the world that's asking nothing of you, and it is giving everything. I want you to take that with you into this holiday season, guys. This perfect gift, this gift of Emmanuel, of God with us, it's a feast large enough for you, and it comes from a place of plenty. As we enter into a season, I think, where we just so often don't have enough, where it feels like we just don't have enough time or enough money or enough space, God's grace is one of plenty. God's feast is abundant. God's feast is free, and the table is large.
To find out more about Redemption Church, visit redemptionbristol.org.